So I have the honor of introducing our last moderator. I think everyone in the room realizes that we have found President Reagan's pony, at least in the Ninth Circuit. Any lawyer in the room would be thrilled to appear before a panel of the Ninth Circuit that was comprised of these three outstanding judges. So because we're running late, I won't read all of Judge Bea's bio, but our moderator for our final panel today is Judge Carlos Bea of the Ninth Circuit.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here again and to introduce the speakers and get out of their way because they're going to have a very spirited debate. Judge Milan Smith stole one of my lines. It's true that the Sixth Circuit has now surpassed the Ninth Circuit as far as rate of reversal. And this is due to the last 7 years, and you have your showing of hope and change. Our panelists today are Dr. John Eastman and Marcy Hamilton. John Eastman, first of all, let me tell you what this is all going to be about. This is a debate on federalism and religious liberty and how federalism affects moral issues like abortion, traditional marriage, and state RFRA laws. That's Religious Freedom and Restoration Act. Cases are in the newspapers all the time about the New Mexico baker who didn't want to bake a cake for a gay marriage, similar to the Washington florist. And now there's a new one in Washington of a state football coach, a state high school football coach, who insists on kneeling at the 50-yard line after the game and saying a prayer by himself, and then he's joined voluntarily by football players, and he's been suspended by the state, by the high school. So what about the intersection of equal protection and religious liberties? Is religious faith and morality inherently in tension with the fidelity to the rule of law? To discuss this matter, Dr. John Eastman is a Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service at Chapman University, Fowler School of Law, and he also served as the school's dean from June 2007 until January 2010, when he stepped down to pursue a bid for the California Attorney Generalship. He is the founding director of the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, a public interest law firm affiliated with the Claremont Institute. Prior to joining Fowler School of Law faculty in August 1999, he served as a law clerk with Justice Clarence Thomas at the Supreme Court of the United States and with Judge Michael Luttig of the United States Court of Appeal for the Fourth Circuit. Marcy Hamilton is one of the United States' leading church-state scholars and holds the Paul R. Vercuil, if I pronounce that correctly, Vercuil, Chair in Public Law at Cardozo School of Law in New York City. She's a senior fellow in the Fox Leadership Program at the University of Pennsylvania, which is part of Penn's program for research on religion and the urban civil society. She is also the academic curator for the National Constitution Center's 2015 Religious Liberty Exhibit and a contributor on the Establishment Clause to the National Constitution Center's Interactive Constitution Project. Marcy clerked for the United States Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and Judge Edward R. Becker of the United States Court of Appeal for the Third Circuit. She successfully challenged the constitutionality of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA, in the Supreme Court in Bernie versus Flores in 1997, and is considered the foremost national scholar and advocate for the victim of for the victims of RFRAs and another statute called RLUIPAs. RLUIPAs, in case you don't have it on the tip of your tongue, is the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. That's a federal act, and there may be some state acts along the way. So this debate will proceed along the following lines. The proposition which will be debated is, do the federal or state RFRAs and RLUIPAs, that is, the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts and the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, which grant certain privileges based on religious action and belief, do they violate federalism? First will be John Eastman, who will say no, and then Marcy Hamilton, who will say yes. Each debater will have 10 minutes, then we will have 5 minutes of rebuttal, and then I'll ask some questions, or they will ask some questions among each other, and then we'll open it up for questions from the floor. So with no further ado, let me present Dr. John Eastman.
Thank you, Judge. It's always a pleasure to be on the stage with you, and thank you for your great service on the Ninth Circuit. I always have to lower the microphone about a foot and a half after after he's up there. This is a bit of a black box debate. Marcy and I have not talked. I have no idea what her views are, and she mine, I suspect. In fact, I learned something. I'd forgotten that she was so involved in the City of Bernie case. I was the law clerk at the court that year, and so I handed you your victory in part, or worked on handing you your victory anyway. So we agree on that the federal RFRA, at least to this extent it intruded on the states, was unconstitutional. I suspect we agree on the fact that RLUIPA, in some of its circumstances, particularly the institutionalized persons part of it, intrudes on states because there's no underlying valid federal spending under Article 1, Section 8. And I represented South Dakota in trying to get that challenge heard. So I'm going to now try and get to the point of things that we might disagree on so we actually have a debate. And I can't quite conceive of what her argument is. So I'm going to lay down the foundations, the founders' foundations on this. Professor Hamilton will undoubtedly persuade you otherwise, and then I'll know what she's going to say, and I'll respond to that. Because she's very persuasive, and I hold her in high regard, so I'm very much looking forward to it. But in my view, not only does do the state RFRAs not violate federalism, but the goals advanced by the state RFRAs are, in fact, one of the principal reasons we have federalism. Let me explain. One of the core first principles that, of course, this society subscribes to is that the federal government is one of limited power. For our purposes, that means primarily that the federal government does not have the police power. That power is specifically reserved to the states. That is the power to foster the health and safety and welfare and morals of the people. That's how we used to describe it. Now, gradually and incrementally, the courts start citing the police power and they drop that last bit, the morals of the people. And yet, that was critically important. In fact, all of the founders agreed that this was not only salutary role for government, but absolutely essential to the experiment in self-government they launched. And on here they drew on the philosopher Montesquieu. We're much more familiar with their drawing on his governmental structures theory of separation of powers. But Montesquieu also had a theory on education and what was necessary for education in different forms of regimes. He said, for example, if you've got a despotism, you've got to have an education that instills fear and obedience in the citizen, or in the citizenry is not the right word, in the subjects. But in a republican form of government more than any other, he said, what you have to instill in the citizenry is moral virtue if they are going to be capable of the self-government that's in order to sustain that experiment. And we find, in fact, this idea prevalent throughout the American founding. In public documents and private correspondence, whatever, it's pervasive. I'll give you just a few examples. The Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, which I remind my friends at Harvard, is still on the books unchanged. The happiness of the people and the good order and preservation of civil society essentially depend upon piety, religion, and morality. By the way, they implemented that with a statute that says it is the duty of the Harvard faculty to instill piety and justice in the students. They have not been honoring, that law is still on the books. They haven't been honoring that there at the Harvard faculty for quite a while. The Virginia Declaration of Rights in 1776 says that no free government or the blessings of liberty can be preserved to any people but by a firm adherence to justice, moderation, temperance, frugality, and virtue, and by frequent recurrence to fundamental principles. Now, you might notice I've done a slight shift from religion to virtue. But the founders, I think, did not think that would have been a shift. They thought the two were intimately connected. For example, in the Northwest Ordinance, which is the one place where the federal government got to exercise a police power, because at the time this was passed, it was dealing with a territory, and the federal government was the state government for the territory, not just the national government. And in the famous line in the Northwest Ordinance, which was adopted both under the Articles of Confederation and one of the first laws readopted after the new Constitution, religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. And of course, George Washington makes the connection between virtue and religion quite explicit in his farewell address, his fatherly farewell address, his instruction to his fellow citizens. You almost get the sense of grandfather saying, here's what I've learned in life I'd like to pass on to you in this farewell address. And he notes, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle. Benjamin Rush was even more blunt on this. Where there is no religion, there will be no morals. All right. So the idea behind the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, in fact, is actually quite limited. The notion that we can give accommodation to religion in order to foster these goals, quite frankly, the founders thought that the states would have even a more aggressive view. As Justice Thomas in 3 or 4 decisions over the last decade has noted, the idea that the Establishment Clause even applies to the states would have been foreign to the founders. Of course, it explicitly didn't apply to them, and none of the Bill of Rights did. But the idea via incorporation that this is somehow a liberty is different in kind than free exercise or freedom of speech. The notion that the states could rely on and support religion aggressively in order to advance their police powers was pretty uniformly accepted by the founders. So where do we go from here, the notion that this is somehow unconstitutional or it violates federalism to let the states do this? Well, you've got to read a very aggressive version of the 14th Amendment, I think, to get there. And that not only do we incorporate fully the Establishment Clause, and there's, the Supreme Court has never confronted the difference in kind of incorporating that clause and making it applicable to the states, the difference in kind in its nature from the free speech or the free exercise or the protections of the Fourth Amendment or what have you. If the First Amendment's Establishment Clause was designed out of a recognition of the importance of religion and a concern that a single national religion would be destructive of religious goals and the fostering of morality rather than conducive to it, that language in the First Amendment, which doesn't say there shall be no national church, that in the debate on the First Amendment was that doesn't go far enough in protecting religion in the states. They changed the language. There shall be no law respecting an establishment of religion. No federal national church, but also no federal interference with the state support of religion otherwise. That Establishment Clause was therefore itself a federalism provision designed to let the states reach different accommodations and different levels of support of religion in their states. As long as you had an exit option and as long as there was no coercion, then both religious liberty but also the fostering of this police power, the health and safety, welfare, and morals of the people and an intimate tie to using religion to accomplish those ends would have achieved. So they all, this was the kind of founding view, and there's nothing in the debates over the 14th Amendment that suggests that by reaching the peculiar issues that had brought us the Civil War and the 14th Amendment, that they were designed to flip that Establishment Clause on its head and allow the federal government's intrusion onto the states, the very thing that the First Amendment's Establishment Clause was designed to prohibit, right? And without something much more explicit, this notion that the Establishment Clause now allows the federal courts and by Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, presumably the federal Congress, to interfere with state support of religion, the very thing that the Establishment Clause prohibited, is really a quite an acrobatic feat. Now, if there's anyone in the country who can do that, it's going to be Professor Hamilton, and I am very much looking forward to hearing her views on the subject, and then we'll engage the debate further.
Well, it's a true pleasure to be here. When the Federalist Society contacted me, And I saw the location was the Reagan Library. I had to agree to come. We were here several years ago, and it's just so magnificent. It's just a pleasure to be here, and good to see you. And nice of you all to stick around this afternoon. I mean, we're in California. I got to go back to lousy weather. So let me just put on the ground that I don't think anybody, even the atheists, think that we shouldn't have religious liberty. We're really just talking about degrees, amounts of religious liberty. So I'd like to go back to our friend James Madison and the framing generation, and then I'll explain why it is I think that our LUPA, the land use application of it, clearly violates federalism, and that the state attorneys general have completely dropped the ball on that. And then I will talk about RFRA and respond to the concept that the state RFRAs are consistent with federal-state relations, because I don't think they are. So James Madison was, of course, concerned about one thing and one thing only, and that was faction. He thought the system that they had concocted actually had a shot, might actually work out. But faction would take it down, and religious faction in particular would take it down. And so while there is a lot of discourse on the right now in the United States about the importance of religion, the more rational, realistic assessment of religion as being conducted by humans and having some moments of overreaching power is where Madison was. Madison was deeply concerned with clericalism. He was an anti-cleric, in fact. But the more important point is that at the framing generation, they had a name for too much liberty. They actually had a name for it. We have lost the ability to discuss too much liberty. They called it licentiousness. Numerous state constitutions protected free exercise except licentiousness. Licentiousness was the concept that someone has completely taken license to avoid the law and not to do the right thing. And so the notion that there are limits on religious liberty are built right into the Constitution. Why would the framing generation have understood the need to have both liberty and limits? For much of that generation, they had come over from Europe to escape theocracies. And those theocracies had used religion to burden them. And they came over here, and originally, many here were also theocracies. It was dangerous to be a Baptist or a Quaker in Massachusetts. You could be killed because you weren't part of the established church. In Pennsylvania, with the tolerant Quakers, you couldn't serve in public office unless you were a Quaker, because you were the only one that had seen the light. So the first thing I'd like to do is just kind of sweep away the idea that all the believers at the time of the framing were singing Kumbaya. They hated each other. There was division. But out of that, the First Amendment created a universe in which we now have over 100,000 sects in the United States living peacefully together so far. How did that happen? By very wise interpretation of the First Amendment. And I give the Supreme Court tremendous credit, and particularly Justice Scalia, when he wrote Employment Division versus Smith and said, look, this is what we've always done. We've always said that if it's a neutral law that's generally applicable, it applies to everybody. Being religious doesn't get you out from under that law. We've always said that it's okay to go to your state legislature and get an exemption. In fact, he looked right at the users of peyote in that case and said, here's two states that have already done this. So what was Smith followed by? It was followed by Annette Plus and religious liberty as the members of the Native American Church fanned out in all the states where they lived in the federal government and asked for exemptions, and they got them in every one. So the result of the 1990 decision in Smith, which is the cause celeb for RFRA, was in fact an increase in religious liberty. But while that was going on, religious entities were demanding RFRA, and RFRA is licentiousness in my view. RFRA is extreme protection for religious liberty. It turns the tables. So while religious believers were not supposed to be a law unto themselves under the First Amendment. The court said it repeatedly. The court held it repeatedly. RFRA says that no believer must abide by any law unless the government can show that it's the least restrictive means for that believer. Least restrictive. In other words, you have to shape the law to fit that particular believer. That is an abandonment of the rule of law and law and order, and a choice that individuals will be laws unto themselves based on their religious beliefs. So what has been the result of this grand experiment with RFRA? Well, first of all, RFRA took to the Supreme Court. Court said it was unconstitutional as a violation of federalism, separation of powers in Article 5, that it was an illegal amendment to the First Amendment because it wasn't done through supermajority procedures. Religious entities then interpreted that to say, oh, it's just federalism that's the problem. Come on, Congress, pass it again. So Congress passes it again, this time by unanimous consent, which should make every conservative in America angry. Unanimous consent is a couple people show up from the leadership and the law is passed. Nobody's there. Nobody has to say how they would have voted. It's used all the time. So RFRA is passed by unanimous consent in 2000, plus the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. I'm going to start with RLUIPA because I think RLUIPA is by far the most seriously problematic part of federal religious liberty legislation right now. So here's what the framers thought, and here's what Madison thought. They assumed anybody that holds power will abuse it. That's why they had to spend so much time at the Constitutional Convention fighting over how to limit the power of each of the branches, limit the power of the federal government, limit the power of the states. And that's why they discussed religion as something that also was going to need to be limited in some way. And that's why we have an Establishment Clause. That no way was religion going to take over the government because they'd seen what happens when that happens. So the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act is now being picked up by developers, wealthy developers. And here is how they're using it. They are going into a city. They are seeing property that they like at a good price in a zone they cannot put their use in. And they are buying it. And then they are going to the city and saying, we want to use this land for this purpose. And the city says, no, that's not permissible purpose here. And then they go straight to federal court. And so now you have federal courts acting as super land use boards. And the religious entities are getting more and more and more brazen. So a group led by a very wealthy developer, ultra-Orthodox developer in Pomona, New York, bought 100 acres of single-family housing land, empty land zoned for single-family housing. They say they want a rabbinical college. What's a rabbinical college? It's a study hall and about 90 acres of multifamily housing. They have been arguing in Pomona for 9 years for the right under a federal law to switch single-family housing to multiple-family housing, and they never filed an application with Pomona once. Not once. They have filed no applications. They have refused to work through the process, completely ignored the local government, and they're in federal court where a federal judge is determining whether or not they're going to be able to transfer single-family housing designation to multifamily housing designation on 100 acres in a town of 3,000. Right? If you think local control ever mattered, it's gone if you have a religious entity invoking RLUIPA. It is just gone. In Bensalem Township in Pennsylvania, two mosques. One mosque buys a piece of property that's perfectly zoned. They go in, they get their approvals, they are sailing through. Second mosque doesn't buy that piece of property. Instead, it buys three pieces of property. It puts together, not one of them zoned for religious use, and goes into federal court and demands that RLUIPA give them that property for that use when they cannot satisfy the land use standards. Right? This is happening all over the country, and neighbors are sick about it. And here is what our LUPA is doing. Our LUPA is persuading the lawyers for the religious groups to make the following argument. Anytime there's a denial and a religious entity is involved, it's discrimination. Local governments are discriminating, even when they're not. So there was a doctrine of local land use in which the federal government, especially the federal courts, were supposed to defer to local land use determinations. It was kind of like the last arena where there was any kind of local control. That doctrine has not been at play at all in the RLUIPA cases. That's unbelievable. You have decades of doctrine requiring deference by federal courts to land use authorities, and what do you get? I've got 1 minute, no sweat. What do you get out of that? What do you get out of that? You get basically local governments being rolled over. So if you want to live in a town with single-family housing, you just better pray to your God that a religious group does not decide they want 100 acres of your property for multifamily housing. Let me close with this in response to the implicit bringing up of the LGBT issues with respect to the state RFRAs. The state RFRAs, in the attempt to give individuals rights over and against the constitutional rights identified by the Supreme Court, is unconstitutional. That's a violation of federalism. Whether we like it or not, Marbury v. Madison says the Supreme Court has the final say on the interpretation of the Constitution, and the interpretation of the Constitution is that there is a fundamental right to marry, even for same-sex couples. And so for the state to enact RFRAs to trump, number one, those rights, but two, to encourage believers to exclude people from the public sphere is surprising. It's very surprising to me. That's not religious liberty, right? That's a demand that in my world, everybody has to believe what I believe. And if they don't believe what I believe, and if they do things I don't approve of, they can't be in my world. That's the creation of many theocracies, which is extremely dangerous. And if our marketplace, our free market, is going to be defined by religion, we are going to see balkanization and difference and a lack of peacefulness that we've never seen in the United States, at least since the framing. Thank you.
Okay, so now I know where the terms of the debate are joined. And on every one of those points, I think I want to take issue. The founders did indeed, I'll start with the one point of agreement. Madison was concerned about faction. The founders had a name for too much liberty. It was licentiousness. So what comes to mind is of the 100,000 sects we have, my favorite story is the woman arrested for prostitution in Los Angeles some years ago. She claimed she was the heiress of an Egyptian goddess. Her religion required all of its congregants to only to be saved if they slept with an heiress of the Egyptian goddess. And like the Catholics, they pass a collection plate at the end, except there was a fixed price tag for the collection plate. That's licentiousness. And the founders had no problem distinguishing that religious claim from other religious claims. And so on that point, I'm in agreement. But here's the problem with the broad rule that comes out of Justice Scalia's opinion in Employment Division versus Smith for religious liberty. See, religious liberty, the founders put in the First Amendment because the freedom of conscience, not to be imposed upon by government, recognized that there is a higher inalienable law, and that no government could legitimately force you to violate your conscience except for the most extraordinary of reasons. And that's why that's there, that protection for freedom of conscience. Justice Scalia's opinion in Employment Division versus Smith says, we can trample your freedom of conscience all we want. As long as we do it uniformly across the board, you have no claim. And if you want to get an accommodation or an exemption from that generally applicable law, Your job is to go petition the political process to do that. Think about what that does. That turns our notion of unalienable rights, which the judiciary is supposed to secure for individuals, against the majoritarian process. It turns those rights only into a gift of government, that what they bestow, they can easily take away. Immediately after the Supreme Court's decision in Hobby Lobby, under RFRA, recognizing Hobby Lobby's right not to have to engage in conduct that violated their conscience, there was a bill introduced in the Senate to repeal RFRA so that we could infringe those conscientious rights. Right? And what Justice Scalia's ruling in Employment Division versus Smith did is reject the notion of inalienable rights, reject the notion that the courts are counter-majoritarian, and that you only get the benefit of the exercise of these core rights if you can persuade a majority to go along with them. That kind of defeats the purpose of independent judiciary and of a Bill of Rights. So I fundamentally disagree with that decision, and I support Congress's efforts to kind of restore a heightened scrutiny to any actions that infringe on your freedom of conscience. I've been involved in a number of the RLUIPA cases on the other side, and so let me give you the picture from my side of the thing. So we had a lovely case down in San Diego. Planning commissioners tend not to be good lawyers, and they talk more than they should on the record. This was a case one of my students worked with here. One of the things they said on the record is, well, why do you need a church? We already have enough churches in town. And they said, well, you don't have one of our denomination. Well, that doesn't matter. You're all alike anyway. We have enough churches in town. There was no parcel of land that wasn't already occupied by a church that was zoned for religious use. That meant they had to seek a conditional use permit even to operate. And the notion that they should have to, and then the Planning Commission voted it down. Said, well, we don't think that there's a need for an additional church in our town. I mean, think about how preposterous it is that any level of government can tell a group of religious believers that they can't have a church in that town. Right? That's how RLUIPA plays out by people on the ground. Yeah, some folks might abuse it and use it, but you know, any law is going to give you. All right, now. Let me take up the issue of why we have the Establishment Clause. We don't have the Establishment Clause to prevent religion from being in the public square at all. As I kind of laid out at the beginning, the difference between an Establishment Clause at the national level and the fact that they deliberately chose not to have such clauses at the state level allowed the states to have different flourishing as long as the states did not coerce. Massachusetts had an established religion all the way up to 1833. It also had a very strong protection. The examples Marcy cites were pre-1780 Constitution. They were colonial days when, you know, you could be killed for not manifesting your obedience to the established church. But they had a very strong protection thereafter for religious exercise, even if not an established church. So the question is the use of religion by state and local governments, or the partnering with religion to advance the police power, is that something that the federal Constitution prohibits? And you've got to really distort the understanding of the 14th Amendment to get there, if my reading of the First Amendment's Establishment Clause is correct. There's certainly nothing in the record in the 1868 debates or the ratifying convention of the 14th Amendment that's what they had in mind. I think the people that passed and ratified that amendment would be shocked to see what they've had in mind. So now let me take up the final challenge that Marcy made, and that is the LGBT issue and the state RFRAs. Nobody is using the state RFRAs to prohibit somebody from getting a marriage license. Nobody. Kim Davis did not do that. What she did is sought a religious accommodation so that she didn't have to issue the license on her authority, which was what the state law required. There were plenty of alternatives for people to get a marriage license, either in another county. They claimed that would be too much of a burden, except they claimed they drove several counties to make that claim in the federal court, so it's a little pretextual. There were deputy clerks in her office, and if none of the deputy clerks were willing to do it, the county executive had the authority under state law to do it. They even asked for the state to pass a law that says the issuance of the licenses is on the authority of the state rather than on the authority of the named county clerk, so that she was not violating her religious faith in exercising her duties of office. The state legislature had thus far refused to do that. So she was seeking a vintage accommodation that was not going to force her religious views on on anybody else. Quite the opposite was the result. That knowing we could get a license with all these other alternatives, the plaintiffs in the case against her were demanding that she be the one to give the license, that she be the one to issue it on her authority, that she be the one to violate her faith in order to accommodate their demand. That was where the imposition was from the other direction. Religious freedom restoration acts in the states are designed to provide that level of accommodation without imposing those views on anybody. Anybody that defends liberty ought to be happy about that outcome rather than concerned about it, it seems to me. Thanks.
Well, I could have predicted we won't agree on anything. But Madison, some of Madison. The tortured and warped propaganda around RFRA is really hard to pierce through, but let me just give you a few facts about RFRA. Employment Division versus Smith was decided the year I was clerking for Justice O'Connor. No one in the building thought that this was a maverick, crazy opinion. None of us were fighting to work on it because it was going to be the most important political opinion of the year. We were fighting over things you've never heard of, like Coquinda. This was a decision that was honest and said in the vast majority of the court's cases, they had recognized the rule of law and that your religious faith was not enough to trump the rule of law. The court was accurate about that. That was, in fact, what had happened. The response to Smith was not because the court changed its standard. The response was because the entities that had been demanding super strict scrutiny for years read Smith as the final word from the court, we're just not giving you this extreme standard. It's because they didn't get what they'd been trying to get all these years, not because the court had changed the standard. Number two, in Churchill Akumi Babalu IA, the court decided a case involving a law that's not generally applicable and said it's unconstitutional. You do apply their version, the Constitution's version of strict scrutiny. And Lukumi decided in 1993, in June, in fact, takes care of this of the horrible behavior that was just described by a city. The notion that, oh, you know, we don't need your kind or we don't like your kind or any of that, that's clearly unconstitutional. And Lukumi takes care of it quite clearly. But Lukumi has never needed to be interpreted because 5 months later, Congress enacted RFRA, which is a much stricter scrutiny. But here is the fact. RFRA is the standard that the court rejected in Lukumi. The court in Lukumi said, we will not use least restrictive means to tailor every law to every believer. And that is what RFRA is. It tailors the law to the subjective perspective of the individual believer and invites the argument that none of us have to abide by any laws with which we might disagree. In a country of 80% of believers, that's a lot of law to disappear. If it's just your faith that gets to trump it. Finally, so Lukumi solves it. The First Amendment does everything we need, but the demand was there because Smith didn't do what they want. I take strong exception, and many on the right, you know, on these issues agree with me. Kim Davis was not asking for vintage accommodation. That is not vintage accommodation. Vintage accommodation is the Christian Scientists asking to be exempt from the medical neglect laws. That's vintage. Being asked to permit them not to treat their children with medical care and perhaps let them die. That's vintage accommodation all over the country and granted in many states, right now most obviously in Idaho. No, there's no such thing as a government official having a right to be able to say that their religious belief means they don't have to serve all the citizens according to their constitutional rights. That's an outrageous claim. Outrageous. And that's why she lost. And that's why, and the reason her they couldn't stay in the office and the gay couple did have to travel. I don't know if you've been to Kentucky. My dad's from Kentucky. It's not easy to get around sometimes. They did have to travel because the deputies refused. If she wouldn't do it, they wouldn't do it either initially. Then they agreed. government is supposed to be true to the federal constitution, and at the same time, government officials are supposed to treat all of us alike. So let me just close by saying, in this whole universe, what I have found most disturbing, the most disturbing statement I have heard recently on religion and federalism and liberty. A student at Liberty University was quoted as saying, was asked, who are you going to vote for president? And she said, well, it's obvious. It's obvious. I'm going to vote for the person who has the same faith I do. That is not the American constitutional scheme. That's a disaster. And if that's where our young people have been persuaded we need to go, we have got to fix it pretty quickly. Thank you.
Now, I'd like to ask the participants a question each, and then we'll open it up to the people from the floor to ask any questions. First question to Professor Eastman. Let's take the case of a devout believer in renovating the ancient Mayan ritual of removing the heart from a young woman as part of a sacrificial religious feat or event. Under your conception, does the fact that there's a religious motivation to the murder provide a defense?
It provides a defense. The defense would not be successful because the government would easily demonstrate a compelling interest in preventing that kind of conduct, and the religious motivation not necessary. But the reason we go to strict scrutiny is to only cover such extreme examples and let your religious faith otherwise flourish without the imposition of government.
I put you the case of a felony, which was murder. In Smith, it was only a misdemeanor, smoking peyote. So religious liberty is a defense if it's a misdemeanor, but not if it's a felony?
No. It turns on the strength of the government's interest. And what Justice Scalia says is, as long as my law is generally applicable, I can impose all sorts of serious burdens on your exercise of religious faith if I want, and that your only recourse is to get an accommodation from the political process, which means you get to exercise your religion if you've got enough clout with the political process, if you're a mainstream religion. But if you're a minor sect, you know, the odds are much greater for you. That means we're not treating this as an inalienable right that pre-exists government. We're treating it as a right that only exists by virtue of government beneficence, and that makes me very nervous.
Professor Hamilton, let's suppose that a municipality adopts a measure for police security, as a police security measure, similar to a measure that was adopted in 17th century Spain that prohibited men from wearing capes that would veil their faces, and says...
You weren't there, were you? You weren't there, no.
Shortly thereafter. And says, no person shall appear in public with a veil over his or her face, including anyone wearing a burqa or any super religious Catholic nun. Would that be a measure that would not violate any religious activity?
We've had these cases, right? And so the law that, let's look at a school. I'll put this in the school context. If you have an inner city school and their biggest problem is contraband of weapons from their students, and they say nobody wears a hat because, frankly, we need to be able to see exactly what you've got. And it turns out that it also affects people wearing burqas. That's constitutional under the First Amendment, and I think it should be constitutional. But if you have a regulation that is intended to single out or target a religious group under the First Amendment, you apply strict scrutiny and it's going to be a lot closer. Now, having said that, even under RFRA, those who will not show their faces for their driver's license can't get a driver's license because that's a privilege and not a right. And so a woman who has on the full face covering does not qualify for a driver's license in the States unless she takes it off for the picture, even though that's in opposition to her faith, for obvious security reasons. So I think that John's given the political process not its due, actually. The United States frequently exempts religious believers in many, many circumstances. And so that's why the cases we're getting under RFRA are the ones that are the more extreme cases, like the right not to serve someone because they're gay, or like the right to carry a knife into a school or carry a knife into a federal building because they're a Sikh. These are issues where RFRA changes it. Let me just, I forgot to open up, though, by the way, by saying that Pete Wilson's my favorite of every governor because he vetoed the RFRA in California. And why did he veto it? Because the juvenile court judges explained to him what happens when religion trumps all the other considerations in custody and you put children at risk. Okay. That's
all
pretty
right,
amazing.
Now, questions from the audience? Do we have a microphone?
Could the current conflicts, to a certain extent, over religious freedom maybe be better reframed as an indication of how far off the rails the administrative state and the government's power under the Commerce Clause has become? To the extent that the federal government in particular intervenes in aspects of people's lives that it did not at the time of the framing or even when the 14th Amendment was passed. I'd be interested in both speakers' reaction to that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that's right. And the greater, the larger the government gets, the more points of conflict with your individual liberty, whether religiously rooted or otherwise. And as the government has expanded, we found that the preserve for exercising your religion has narrowed. And in fact, they no longer even talk of the freedom of religion. They're now talking about the freedom of worship. And what is that change in terminology intended to accomplish? That means it's something that is indulged only in the mosque or the church or the synagogue, or maybe in the privacy of your homes, like Justice Scalia said, like pornography. I remember in Lee versus Weissman, right? But for most religious believers, it is not something you turn in, on and turn off when you walk in or out of the church. It's something that guides the conduct of your life. And if we really believe that there are natural rights that pre-exist government, then the notion that we have to beg the political process, the majoritarian of those who may not agree with our particular religious views, we have to beg their indulgence to exercise our freedom of religion when it's not causing harm, significant harm to society to do so, really gets it upside down, it seems to me.
You want to chime in on that, Marcy?
I disagree. with respect to the Commerce Clause is the reason that RFRA was reenacted. They did it based on the Commerce Clause, and the argument is that anything a religious group does affects commerce somehow, and therefore they have the right to have extra rights. So, yes, I think the expansion of the Commerce Clause is extremely troubling. That's why I argued vociferously the federalism issues in Bernie, and that's probably why I won in Bernie, because we had a relatively conservative Supreme Court that was very interested in federalism. Current court is not nearly as interested in federalism, but is willing to provide for expansive religious liberty according to their own lights. And so in Hobby Lobby, what did the court say was, and it's got nothing to do with what's the compelling interest, if the government has an interest. That the whole ball game of RFRA is in least restrictive means. That's the whole ball game. Government can always come up with some interest, but the government doesn't get to enforce a law unless it's the least restrictive means for this believer. And so what did our Supreme Court tell us was the least restrictive means to handle the fact that $3.2 billion industries like Hobby Lobby would decide that they're not going to provide certain contraceptions to their female employees who've been hired under a law that does not permit them to hire according to religion? What was the upshot of that. The court said that a least restrictive means would be for the federal government to pay for all women's contraception, neither politically nor economically feasible then or now. That's where we are. We have become a country in these religious liberty cases where the judges are the lawmakers. This is Lochner of the new era, and for anybody who thinks unelected judges shouldn't be carving out public policy, you ought to watch the RFRA and RLUIPA cases, because the federal judges are carving up public policy without any consideration of local, state consideration, and basically saying, if we can imagine it, that's the least restrictive means.
I'm generally perplexed, Marcy. I thought you were much more libertarian in outlook than that. If it's an invalid means for the federal government to provide contraceptive services for free directly because it's too costly, how can it possibly be constitutional for them to demand that some people pay for the contraceptive services for others as a condition of running your business? I mean, that is quite apart from the religious aspect of the claim. That's an unbelievable intrusion on liberty. It's what James Madison, since we both agreed on James Madison, said is the very definition of tyranny, taking property from A and giving it to B. Now, at least if the federal government had to pay for that service, they would tax us generally and have to get through the taxing process, but they passed a law that says by mandate I can force A to transfer his property to B because we think it's a good idea that B has your property instead of A. That's an unbelievable intrusion on liberty. It's patently unconstitutional, and I'm surprised you think that's a good solution.
Well, I'm actually surprised you think it's unconstitutional after the Affordable Care Act case. I mean, come on. Justice Roberts upheld. That game is over. I know everybody
I disagree on the notion that just because the Supreme Court speaks, that becomes the new constitutional norm. I think they make grievous mistakes, and that is one of them.
That is a reversal of Marbury v. Madison. And
Marbury never staked that claim. Marbury says the Constitution is higher than all three branches.
Yes, it did. No.
And it doesn't say we get to decide and rewrite the Constitution, and that becomes the supreme law of the land.
No, it says the court's interpretation is the last word on the meaning of the Constitution, even if there are some people with sour grapes.
And even if it's directly contrary to the text of the Constitution, it never made such claim. That doesn't come for 150 years
that
later.
Would be incorrect. On your interpretation, the Southern schools did not need to desegregate because they thought the Supreme Court had misread the Constitution.
No, I didn't say that.
No, that's just the implication. That's logic.
The Southern claims were wrong. The Supreme Court happened to get that right, but they got Dred Scott wrong, and I wouldn't give deference to Dred Scott. They got Plessy wrong. I wouldn't give deference to that. They got Roe wrong. I wouldn't give deference to that. And they got the Affordable Care Act case wrong, and I wouldn't give deference to that.
You can't pick and choose the constitutional holdings you like.
No, but you can look. We'll close with this because we're out of time. Abraham Lincoln's first inaugural in the Reagan Library says if the opinion of nine unelected judges are to become the final resolution of disputed controversies, we will cease to that extent to be a self-governing people. And that means we cannot accept this claim of judicial supremacy. When they claim that they can substitute their interpretation, however crazy it is, and that it, rather than the Constitution and the laws made in pursuance thereof, are the supreme law of the land, we have lost the ability to govern ourselves.
We never had it. This is not a direct democracy, even though we're in California.
We've passed the 4:30. Please join me in giving a hand to the two debaters.